This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week is Paul Jaisley, staff editor and contributor for comic books, and Nick White, staff contributor for comic books. How have you guys been? How are comic books?
Comics are good. I read a pretty diverse selection of stuff over the past week. Kind of the big thing I read was Paying for It by Chester Brown. It came out a few years ago. Have either of you heard of this book? It's a diary OGN.
No, I've never heard of it. Is this one of those books that like you and 17 other people have all of the copies and that's it? And so none of us should reasonably be expected to have read this.
No. I think Fantagraphics published. No, Drawn and Quarterly published it. So it's actually pretty.
Decent distribution in some way.
Yeah, and I found a copy at the library. It's one of these books that is really, really well done and well made, and there's a lot of craft and care that went into it, but I don't think I liked it. And it's something I've noticed has been happening more and more for me. Well, basically, Chester Brown is like an indie comic artist in Toronto, and this book, Paying for It, is his diary of when he was soliciting prostitutes. He had broken up with his girlfriend, and he just decided, like, he had no moral objection to being a John. So it's basically every encounter with a prostitute he had for a 5-year period that the book covers.
Wow.
Yeah, and he's a very talented writer. I admire his honesty and his transparency on the topic. But I don't think I liked it as a story or a book. So,
what was it that you didn't necessarily like?
Without getting too into it, I guess the problem with the book is that right in the beginning of the book, the preface, he makes a point in saying he had very deep personal conversations with these women when he was visiting them.
Okay.
But he can't include any of their personal details in the book for their own privacy, which is understandable.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when he draws them, he doesn't draw their faces. He has very general sort of comments about their appearance. He uses fake names for them, all in an effort to protect their privacy, which I totally understand. The problem is that makes all of the women he's visiting very one-dimensional characters. Yeah. They can't be fully fleshed out people in the book.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I understand why he did that out of necessity, but I think it hinders the point of the book, right?
Right. And
there's large portions of the book, both in the book itself and the appendices, of which there are many, where it's him giving his, I don't know if it's libertarian, but it feels libertarian sort of arguments for why decriminalizing prostitution is the best option. So it reads almost like a debate about the topic at points rather than a diary.
Huh.
I think, like I said, I think it's a very well-made comic. I'm just not sure if I could recommend it wholeheartedly. But it's one of those things that I read that over the week, and it gave me a lot to think about in terms of the topic, obviously, of the book and the nature of comics to tell these kinds of stories. So, yeah. And one other thing I have to mention, I read Batman 66, number 66 and 67. This is the digital first series by Jeff Parker, where it's Batman stories set in the continuity of the 60s TV show.
Oh, yeah. I read that in trade.
Okay, yeah. I'm not reading it regularly like I did when it first started, but I picked these two issues up digitally because they're the story issues where Jeff Parker introduces Bane into the continuity.
So you
can imagine the character Bane on the 60s TV show, and basically Jeff Parker turns him into a luchador.
This is basically
the perfect comic for me. You have Adam West Batman literally wrestling Bane as a luchador in a ring. I fucking loved it.
Oh, no.
Loved it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that was probably the best thing I read this week for obvious reasons. Yeah.
And the wrestling comic book crossover thing continues in another week. Great.
Exactly. Had to get in there.
Just perpetually for the last week, Paul's just had Walking on Sunshine playing in the back of his mind. He's just like, do.
Exactly. Yeah. It would, if you know anything about me, that comic just was right in my wheelhouse. just perfect.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
All of these like comic book publishers are like, guys, we got to at least do wrestling plus whatever we're doing, because at least we know Paul Jacely will show up.
You got yeah. one sale. Buy that. Guaranteed.
We got to target yeah. that Paul Jace, that Paul Jacely money.
It's a very narrow market, but man, if they could aim for it, I appreciate it.
100% success rate. I can't wait to go into Barnes & Noble and next to Supernatural Teen Romance, there's going to be the Paul Jacely section.
Girl, yeah, exactly. Yeah, wrestling, books about wrestling, and comics about teenage girl superheroes in bands. Apparently those are like my my audience. So.
Well, Nick, what'd you read this week?
Let me see. I read Ivar Timewalker. That was kind of interesting. I think it's now the second issue with the new artist, who is Francis Portella. And I can't say I'm crazy about his artwork, but I think we're going to be moving on to somebody new within the next month or two. You know, Valiant, really, at the end of every arc, the artist changes. And honestly, like, I'm okay with that. I think, like, if you would have asked me, like, a year and a half ago, I would have gotten, like, all upset and have been like, well, you know, if I like the artist, I don't understand why things have to change. He said, as a not-so-subtle allegory about life. But I'm totally okay with it now. I read that. That was kind of interesting, especially because it tied back into... I think I was telling you, when I picked up that huge bundle of Archer and Armstrong, I was like, I think there's still going to be some little bits and pieces in here that are going to weave their way into Ivar Timewalker. And sure enough, like, Amelia Earhart, who's lost into this weird void in time, that's how they explain why we never found her, even though recently history would suggest otherwise. That aside, they sort of weave her back in to Ivar Timewalker. So I read that, and then I also read in one sitting, I didn't think I was going to, but it's Geoff Johns. It's basically like a literary popcorn for the soul, or whatever you want to call it. I read Justice League Volume 5, which, interestingly enough, is sort of the counterpart to Forever Evil. It's sort of like happening at the exact same time. It sort of does some of the origin stories for the bad guys, and it also mainly follows Cyborg, as he's the only one that isn't really sucked into that vortex thing, and his effort to combat the evil syndicate, the whatever crime syndicate.
The crime syndicate.
Wait, is it the crime syndicate?
It is the crime syndicate. Nick, I read it last night. Okay. I read Forever Evil last night. It's crime syndicate, all right?
I thought the crime syndicate were the guys from Earth 2, and they opened up the door for the bad guys from Earth 3.
I think what happened, seeing that I've read both of those books in very recently,
yeah.
The Earth 2 book with the Crime Syndicate is Crime Syndicate with a K, and it's spelled K-R-Y-M-E, so it's totally different. That's all.
Okay. Anyway.
I'm not 100% certain about that, but I think they were supposed to be the same guys, but this is the Forever Evil version of them was the New 52's incarnation of that, which is a whole weird thing about their whole DC's multiverse, but... Yeah.
Okay. I guess I'll have to go back and look that up, because I'm pretty certain Earth 2 is Syndicate. You know, like the one where Joker's the good guy and Bruce Wayne's the bad guy and Alfred's the bad guy, and anyway. But yeah, so I read that. That was kind of interesting. It sort of reminded me again, I hadn't had a book in a while where you look in the credits and you see writing by so and so, pencils by so and so, and then it says finishes by. And I hate to say it, but every time I see the phrase finishes by, I just get really scared.
Yeah.
Finishes, at least to my understanding, and I'm sure Paul knows too, finishes is when, like, someone sort of has to polish, or, as it suggests, finish the main artist's work, in a way. Like, the main, yeah.
Ugh. I can't imagine that ever turns out great.
Yeah. So, like, it was Doug Mankey and Ivan Reyes, or however you say his name, maybe it's Ivan, and, for a couple of their issues, there were finishes done by Joe Prado and a couple other guys, and it looked okay, but I was just really shocked that for such a big book, you know, Justice League, they were doing finishes. I thought that was kind of odd, for something like that.
Well, and they gotta get the issue out. I think that's what it comes down to. They have to get the issue out, so they need someone to just wrap this up.
Yeah.
And get it out on time. I think that DC has probably a much harder line in terms of what is an okay delay versus any delay at all, you know?
Right. Well, clearly Marvel has demonstrated in Secret Wars that that line is drawn in the sand, you know. It's
and the wind is blowing. Yeah, the wind is blowing.
Yeah, yeah. I heard some weird conspiracies that has something to do with Fantastic Four in some weird ways, but we won't go into that right now. But
that's a whole different topic.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what I read, and I'm just shocked you've never heard of Finishes before. I guess you'll have to go look.
Yeah,
that
either
up.
I may have seen it, but I just never realized it. I don't know. I think, well, the thing is, okay, so, you know, I read a bunch of Marvel books. I think Marvel, instead of saying finishes by, they'll just say art by X, Y, and Z.
Or additional art by. Sometimes you get that.
Or additional
Sometimes
art.
Sometimes you get that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a much more veiled way of putting it.
For me this week, I read a bunch of my single issues. I read Archie number 2, which was so pleasant and so amazing. I read Injection.
Do you read that
I
in print
caught up
or digital?
On a bunch of stuff.
I'm sorry, Mike.
Well, no, that's okay. I read Archie. I've been buying Archie both digitally and in print because I want to get the special variant covers. I like the variant covers for Archie have been killer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for number one, I bought it digitally. Like I pre-ordered it on Comixology. From there, but then I went to the comic shop and saw that Midtown Comics had 1,000,000,000,000 variants. So I grabbed the Zdarsky cover because I was like, hey, Chip Zdarsky, I like that cover. And then for this week or for this month's issue, I saw that they had the Paulo Rivera cover.
Ooh.
And I really like that one. It's like it's the cover that has Archie sitting in a chair, and behind him is like the classic looking Archie characters, and it looks like an artist is drawing a caricature of his character. Love that. I love that cover. So I grabbed that one, and I also got it digitally. But that was Archie is so much fun. I don't know what it is. It's a total breath of fresh air, as I've said before. So I read that, and I caught up on some other stuff. Read Uber finally, the last issue of Uber for this quote unquote year of Uber. In terms of Kieran Gillen's taking a break until sometime next year on the book. If you're into crazy ass fictional history with superheroes with blood and guts and everything, it's a pretty cool book. I think Kieran Gillen puts a whole lot of love into it. So if you're a history buff and you like World War II and you don't mind a ton of violence, it's a pretty good book. Other than that, I was reading, like I said, a bunch of my single issues, and I read Forever Evil last night. Like, I started it at 2 in the morning, and then I read it until 4, and I was reading it on my Chromecast, because I have it on Comixology, so I was casting my tab that I was reading it in on the TV. It worked out, actually, pretty well. I think David Finch's paneling, like, was pretty well suited for a 42-inch TV or whatever. It was a killer book. Like, the presentation aside, like, that book was... I got, like, 20, 30 pages in, and I was just like, oh, man, everything's so fucked up. What are they going to do?
Yeah.
Lex Luthor's got to save the world. I was geeking out. I don't read... Like, I've said this million times, and the more and more DC I read, I got to stop saying it, but I don't really read a lot of DC. So a lot of these characters I just know from reference, or I've seen them once, or, you know, in the case of, like, Captain Cold, I know him from the TV show, but I also know him from the few issues of Justice League that I read. So it was really cool, and everybody was so evil, and everybody was a bad guy. And then I really just hated Batman throughout the whole book, because I really just wanted Lex Luthor to just run the show. And he did. And then Sinestro showed up out of nowhere. And plot holes aside, it was a really fun book. There were some problems that I had with it, which I'm sure other people have pointed out, you know, seeing that this book has been out for a long time. But man, it was fun. It was like the most cinematic... Like, you know, we talked about cinematic books last week, but this felt like it wasn't storyboards. It was just like an epic masterpiece that we've talked about, like how Geoff Johns, he crafts these overarching, humongous stories. And they're, as you said before, Paul, they're dumb, but they're also incredibly entertaining, because you're like, well, of course the Lex Luthor knows how to fix this thing. Or of course Sinestro could just fix Black Adam's jaw at this one point. Sorry, spoilers, whatever. But... at the same time, it was perfect. There was nothing wrong with the book that made it a bad comic book, and I enjoyed it from beginning to end. And I even liked the way that they wrap things up to set up further storylines, and why Dick Grayson is now Grayson or whatever the hell his book is called.
That's
makes
right.
way more sense yeah. to me now. So I really, really liked it. It was so much fun, and I didn't think that I was going to enjoy it as much as I did. So I don't know. Do you guys like that book?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, yeah, I put off reading it for a long time just because I was avoiding big event books and stuff. But like you said, it really nails that classic big, kind of dumb, doesn't quite work all the way, but you really enjoy it superhero story that
yeah
I think are kind of rare, those kind of big stories. at least of that quality. And yeah, Geoff Johns is doing a really good job with that. With that book and the current Justice League, I'm liking for the exact same reason.
Cool. Yeah. Well, it was a good week. So you guys want to talk about your comic picks for this week? On top of, you know, we could keep gushing about other stuff that we've read, but let's talk about what we're reading this week. So, Paul, what are you reading this week? What's your pick?
Well, the single title on my list this week is Superman 43. So I guess by default, it's my comic pick. It's the only thing coming out that I'm interested in reading. But I'm really enjoying the current Superman story, both in Superman and Action Comics. I think it's a really interesting take on the character. So this is the series Superman that's being written by Gene Yang with art by John Romita Jr. And not to give too much away, but I think everyone knows at this point, this is the story where Lois Lane finds out that Clark Kent is Superman, and we're leading up to her revealing it to the world. So the events of Action Comics take place after the events in Superman. So in Superman, we're kind of getting the lead up to what's going on in Action Comics. It's really interesting because
they switched places.
What's that?
You're saying they switched places? Holy cow.
It's really interesting. It's not as big a difference as it was when the New 52 started. It's just maybe like a few weeks time difference, but it makes for an interesting read because in Action Comics, the current storyline is called Justice, and the recent issues have involved these topics like police brutality and Superman standing up for disenfranchised communities in Metropolis. Very contemporary, you know, pulled from the headlines kind of stories dealing with the topic of justice. In Superman, the storyline is called Truth, and that's what it's about. It's this idea that Clark Kent has been keeping a secret and basically lying to Lois Lane for all these years. Why has he been doing that? Is it to protect her, or is it something else? So it's playing with that idea of truth, right, in the sense of the character. And I really like the way that Gene Yang on Superman and Greg Pak on Action have been playing with these larger ideas with the character without changing anything about the character itself or himself.
So is there going to be another book called The American
Way?
That's coming. Okay. I just had to drop that in there.
No, I understand. No, and I think
You're not the first.
Exactly. I think it's worth mentioning, or at least noting, that right now the two writers in charge of the Superman franchise are Asian American.
Right.
So when you have these big publishers dealing with issues of diversity, the fact that the people writing the biggest superhero, most well-known superhero in history right now, and doing that in a very sort of engaging and, you know, almost not controversial, but contemporary issues sort of way, are these Asian American writers. So I think it's worth noting and pointing out this example of diversity working really well in comics, because they're doing a fantastic job in making Superman stories that I think are exciting for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I enjoy it. Yeah.
Cool. Well, Nick, what are you reading this week?
This week, I've got a pretty stacked deck, but I went with Fall of Ninjak. Ninjak is also coming out this week, just to make things, you know, just a double dose of Ninjak, if that's what you wanted. Apparently, they're more than willing to cater to that interest. But yeah, I really liked the first one-shot from Book of Death with Bloodshot, and I'm really excited to see what they do with the Ninjak one. It's Matt Kint and Trevor Hairsign. Trevor did the first arc of Eternal Warrior. He also did the Bloodshot story arc during Armor Hunters. And he's got a real sort of sketch-heavy sense to his pencils, which I really like. I'm just really interested to see where this goes, because with these tie-ins to Book of Death, they've not been afraid to do all sorts of super, super weird things, like a Death of Bloodshot goes on for hundreds, if not thousands of years after the contemporary events take place. They go on for hundreds and thousands of years, and he like treks across the Arctic wasteland, and they did all sorts of goofy things where he gets abducted by aliens and basically forced to fight in this thing called the Robot Wars, and I'm hoping that with Ninjak there's something slightly more grounded, obviously, because Ninjak is not, he doesn't have nanites in his blood, you know, constantly regenerating his cells, so one can expect that he's not going to have something totally insane to that level happen. But Valiant hasn't been afraid to like sit down and have these crazy issues that go on for hundreds of years and talk about weird events. Like there's this thing called like the Vine Execution, which gets name dropped. There's this other thing they're talking about in the preview for Ninjak called, like, the Armor Hunter Wars, where the Armor Hunters come back. And what's so interesting is we have all these little things that are just name-dropped. It's like, we know that this, whatever this event is or that event is, like, it's monumental, it's huge. Like, he talks, Ninjak talks about in the preview how, like, whatever this was wiped out every other member of Unity. And, but that's all, we don't actually get to hear anything about it. So we're hoping that either Book of Death or other issues will actually supplement that. But I think this issue is going to be really, really interesting, because it begins by saying, like, 100 years later, and Ninjak is still alive, presumably at, like, the age of, like, 130 or 135, and he's got some weird, like robotic arm of some sort, and you're like, what the fuck is going on? But that's great. It honestly feels a bit like an Elseworlds tale, if you're talking DC, or a... I mean, why did they call it this? Marvel, this is just not creative. I think they call them Marvel What Ifs.
Yeah, Nick. Better than Elseworlds, duh.
Okay. Let me know when What If comes up with Gotham by Gaslight, and then we'll talk. But yeah, I really like the freedom that they have with these books. And even if they set up all of these things, like all these weird future events, and then like none of them ever come to pass, that would be, I don't know. I still think the level of care and detail that's going into this, even if these things are throwaway or whatever, is just, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, I sent you that crazy flow chart. Someone, I hope legally or with permission, took a picture in like the Valiant editorial office of them mapping out all of Book of Death, and it's just crazy.
Yeah, that's it's absurd. I mean, and then it's a question of, and I realize this might be opening a can of worms. I'm kind of wondering, will this backfire on them? Could this potentially backfire on them by putting points in time near in the future and saying, well, we have to at some point lead to this, no matter what? And this is where you run into continuity stuff where they're like, oh, well, that was in a different timeline, so we don't have to adhere to that. And it's like, okay, well, you guys promised me one thing and then showed me another, so now what? So I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely understand the concern. Like, are these things they're going to be held to, or is this something that later down the line they're going to be caught up in? Well, you said this was going to happen in 100 years, and I've been keeping track on my own personal timeline, and you didn't do it. And first off, that's sad. Second off, Big Two have been doing this forever. And even DC most recently did it with Future's End, where, you know, all of these things are supposed to come to pass in 5 years, and they always find their way out of it. Valiant has made it clear that there will be some fallout from this. I mean, the whole structure of Book of Death is that it's two narratives in one. It's this attempt to deal with keeping this horrible prophecy and all of these huge fallout events that happen because of that prophecy from happening. And then it's also the stories from the Book of the Geomancer that tell what will happen if they don't. So certainly we're getting these narratives, and the fall of Bloodshot, the fall of Ninjak, all of these things are also hailing from that Book of Geomancer thing. So some of these things could be prevented, some of them could be avoided altogether, some of them, parts of them may come true, and other parts might not. So yeah, I mean, like any comic book publisher, they've already found a way to weasel their way out. But Valiant has claimed that, I mean, this is so comic booky, but someone is not going to make it out of this alive. Surprise.
Bum, bum, bum.
Which, when you consider how many Valiant characters are immortal, that actually is going to be interesting. Because, like a third of them can't die, so...
That's an interesting problem to have.
Yeah.
Well, for me this week, I'm also reading a Valiant book because... I'm excited because Alice Cott's writing a Valiant book, so this just merges two great worlds in one. Dead Drop number 4 comes out this week, which is the last of the miniseries, all about some people trying to catch some other people at the same time, you know? No, the story is about this idea of these dead drops. If you haven't been reading this book, I'll just give you a brief overview, I guess, where there are these things like USB ports that are just, you know, cemented into walls. This is a thing that was in some news story a while ago, maybe a year ago or so, where they're just USB ports where you could just plug in a flash drive.
What?
And you could, like, yeah, and you could just get data from it and stuff. It's bizarre. It's this really cool idea of, whoa, there are just places where you can store data anonymously or get data anonymously. Mm. And so the idea of Dead Drop is, well, what if someone had this ultimate terrible virus that was somehow stored on a flash drive, and someone went and picked it up. So there's this terrorist group that supposedly is trying to take this virus and kill everyone in New York, and it starts at a dead drop. And this person needs to get to another dead drop to make the handoff to give this virus to another person. And who is it? Exo Man of War shows up.
Yep.
And decides, well, we can't let that happen. And there's a lot of like Valiant stuff that I'm not necessarily 100% familiar with that's going on. Some guy named Neville is kind of in control of everything.
Oh, he's Ninjak's handler.
Okay, so he's Ninjak's handler, and so you don't really need to know the specifics of who all these people are necessarily. Like, they kind of give a little bit of a breakdown of who they are, but the important part is like what's happening in the story is these people are running away, and this concept of dead dropping, and why it's important that people can exchange data freely, and this is like the opposite side of it, why it's a bad thing that data can be exchanged freely. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're highlighting the point that there's nothing we can do about it. Like, if there's a will, there's a way. And Exo Man of War is trying to prevent this woman who has this USB drive and this guy who's driving her around from basically dropping off this USB thing to kill everyone. And it's been a really fun book, and I feel like I need to reread all of it after reading a bunch more Valiant. I think it'll put things in a little bit more of a perspective. But it's a fun story. It's pretty action-packed, and it's really, really fast-paced. Like, I read through this issue in minutes just because of how, like plot point after point after point it is. And it's really exciting, so I'm pretty excited about it. I mean, Ellis Cott is definitely trying to make a statement about these dead drops and about like the freedom to exchange information, mm-hmm. but at the same time adding a little bit of a sci-fi twist onto it, kind of like what he's doing in Wolf, but with supernatural mm-hmm. stuff.
Right.
This is a fun book.
Cool.
Nick, are you reading this at all?
I read the first issue. I don't know what it is about the book. I don't know if it's like super popular. Or if, like, the print count is low, but, like, I read the first issue, and I was like, you know what, if I see the rest around, I'll get them, but, like, I didn't pull it in time, and I never found any issue other than number one, and I only found that when I was vacationing in Chicago, so I don't know if it's really popular or what, but I did order the trade, so I'm eagerly waiting for that. Yeah, it's, with Ellis Cott, I always like when he's put into a situation, and I know this sounds terrible, because it sounds like it's, like, I love it when Ellis Cott is really put into a situation where he has to at least toe the line to some extent.
Yeah.
So you get some of yeah. his more interesting ideas, but they're filtered through a different framework where he can't go batshit insane.
Yeah.
And I know Paul's like, but I really love it when he goes absolutely nutsoid and there's no right? filter. And
exactly.
And I know certain people appreciate that, but for me... you know, I still believe in Ma and Pa and the American way and, you know, apple pies, you know, cooling on the windowsill. And so for me, I like my ideas maybe filtered through a character that I'm familiar with or things like that. This is a much more palatable Ellis Cott narrative that I think I can handle, much like his Suicide Squad run where DC went, well, that's nice, but you're still being a little too weird, and yeah. at least to my understanding, kicked yeah. him off the book. But yeah, I mean, I read the first one, I loved it, I can't wait for the rest, because it really is sort of a fast-paced, like, chase. It's like a whole, like, crazy chase sequence.
Yeah, the whole series has been nonstop running, and at one
like
point...
kind of like Mad Max for me, in a way.
Yeah, you know, it's like Armstrong nonstop. Shows up, or Archer shows up, I'm sorry, Archer shows up, and he's weird, and like from what I read in Archer and Armstrong versus the Archer that's in this book, like, totally different characters, but there's enough remnant of the character that I go, that's definitely him. But Cott has taken the character to like his furthest extent of weirdness and crazy, like, homeschooled, like, uber yeah. conservativeness that I didn't think was like absolutely present in Archer and Armstrong, but it's totally present in the few moments that he's in Dead Drop. And it's really cool, just if you have a little bit of an understanding of who's in the Valiant universe, to see people kind of drop in and out of this book really quickly. It's a lot of fun in that regard, because Cott has no filter for them a lot of the times, because they're only in the book for so long that he just goes, well, I'm going to do the weird thing that I've always wanted to do with this character, and then they're gone. And Nick, to your point of him, you know, being like constrained in a way, I think that to me shows like a different level of creativity in terms of writing a book like
oh,
this,
sure.
where you say, how can you do something crazy and weird within the confines of this box?
In some ways, I think that's tougher.
Right, and well, and the funny thing is, like, I think we're in a different era now of in terms of comic book writers of, like, notability, where you don't find out who someone is through their big two books. You maybe find out from them, find out, like, who they are through their independent books that are wild and batshit crazy, like Kot, for instance. And then when you bring them back to a, I guess, like a bigger publisher or a publisher that has constraints like this because they're licensed books, and you say, well, how are they going to operate within this? And then you say, oh, man, that was a weird twist. That was really cool. Only they could have thought of that. That's like Warren Ellis going off and doing all of his weird indie books and then coming back to the big two, and specifically to Marvel, and writing a book. I go, wow, this is definitely the same guy, but I can see how he's managed to make his weird way of writing or telling a story work within the confines of the Marvel book, or, you know, anything else that he's writing that's a licensed property. And I really, really enjoy that. I think that's something that we're going to see more and more of, where people are, you know, getting big from their indie books where they've been wild and out there, and then they come and they try to do something within the confines of these books. Like, I think, like, Gene Yang, for instance, doing a, you know, a DC book, doing action, or Superman, I'm sorry. I think, you know, his books are what? I've never read any of his books, but I think, Paul, you mentioned that he's done more indie, he's definitely done more indie stuff and more, like, like, down-to-earth stuff, right? And to see him on, like, a super big book like Superman is a totally different perspective, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's kind of refreshing to see that. See someone who's not just coming at it from a different angle, but has a different style of writing, almost a different approach to making comics, taking on a big character like that. It's really exciting.
Yeah. And I think that's something, I mean, Kot, I think, definitely has more breathing room probably at Valiant, because I think Valiant is still new and they're trying to establish themselves still, even after their big debut. But to have him work within the confines of their universe to make things work has been really interesting. And the book is a lot of fun, too. Like Nick said, it's fast-paced. It's like Mad Max in a way, where everything's just on the move constantly. And so this will be a killer conclusion to the miniseries. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. Yeah. So that's comic books. That's comic books for this week. Thanks, guys. I'm glad that we all have books that we like.
Yeah.
and so this is going to be a weird week for the listeners. This is going to be a weird week only because we're not going to actually talk about anything this week. Instead, we are going to, after the break, we're going to dump in this little bit of thing that we recorded probably a month and a half ago, where we talked all about Transformers versus G.I. Joes. So, Paul, do you have any thoughts on this? I know this was kind of your idea, so if you want to, I don't know, want to explain it a little bit, like why we went and did it and everything?
Yeah, I'm sure if you've listened to more than one episode, you know that I'm a big fan of Transformers versus G.I. Joes, the IDW series by Tom Scioli and John Barber. And I'm such a big fan, I was able to convince both Mike and Nick to read it, despite their maybe hesitations to do so. I really think it's one of the best comics, or at least the most interesting comics being published right now. Whether you have a fondness for or nostalgic feelings for the franchises of Transformers or G.I. Joes or not, it's such an interestingly made comic. Tom Scioli's art style and narrative style is reminiscent of early 70s Jack Kirby, but he's able to push that in different directions. And I think the book itself is kind of a testament to creative experimentation in a way. The fact that IDW as a publisher and Hasbro as the toy company that owns the rights to these franchises is giving Scioli and Barber the ability to just do whatever that they want in a comic book is pretty exciting. And we'll get into it obviously when you listen to the conversation, but just the approach to storytelling, the approach to the medium makes it a book worth checking out, even if you're not a fan of the characters involved. So I hope that comes through in our conversation. I think it does.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, you're going to hear us talk about issues 1-7 of Transformers vs. G.I. Joe. Number 8 came out a couple weeks back, so this is a little bit dated in terms of what's happening. So spoilers, I think, for 1-7. But nonetheless, hopefully you will listen to this and you will enjoy it, and maybe give Transformers vs. G.I. Joe a chance. It really is a killer book. I'm sure you've all been looking forward to our very, very sought after discussion of Transformers versus G.I. Joe. And this week, we are proud to bring that to you. Now, we're recording this earlier than we recorded the first half of the episode, so I hope that's not a problem for you. But nonetheless, we wanted to talk about Transformers versus G.I. Joe. So with me, Paul and Nick, let's talk about Transformers versus G.I. Joe. In specific, let's start with just talking about... Actually, let's go back and let's give a little background about this series. So Transformers versus G.I. Joe is a series published by IDW, written by John Barber and Tom Scioli, with art by Tom Scioli. Anything else you guys want to fill in about the series?
I think it's the best comic book being published right now. And I'll explain why. So yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Nick, anything?
Them's fighting words. I don't know. I think Paul feels very passionate about it. I feel kind of threatened by how passionate Paul is about it. And it's definitely one of the most unique books out there. And I don't think many other people that are working with such an established cash cow franchise have the balls to do what these guys are doing with this book.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, seeing that we've talked about this series like 100 times on the podcast, it only serves that we should actually do an in-depth discussion. So, Paul, let's talk about story. I know you've got a lot of notes. Nick, I know you've got notes. I've got some thoughts. So let's just dive right into it.
Yeah. I mean... You know, I say that this is, I think, the best comic being published right now, and I'm being maybe a little facetious, but like Nick said, it's definitely the most unique book out there right now. There's nothing else like it on the stands, and a lot of that comes down to Tom Scioli's artwork and the way he uses the art as a narrative device. I mean, we'll get more in depth on that, but I came into this book kind of cold, knowing really nothing about Transformers or G.I. Joe, despite growing up in the 80s. But I was already a fan of Scioli's art, so I was just excited to read it for that, and it did not disappoint. So the book starts with a bang. I mean, this book starts with basically Decepticons landing on Earth and fighting G.I. Joes, and you get 7 issues so far of just Transformers fighting G.I. Joes, just like the title says. What really stands out for me is just the scope of the book. You go from 0 to 60, and it doesn't really slow down until about issue 7, which we'll get into. But the initial impression of the book is just, this is just the craziest, most elaborate fight scenes, just one after another, which sounds like it get boring, but because Scioli's artwork is so unique, and he plays and experiments with the format, it's a fascinating book to read. Even if you have no idea what's going on, it's amazing just to look at and kind of absorb. Is that kind of what you guys think of it?
Yeah, that's basically it for me. There are pages upon pages and sometimes an entire issue where I am totally confused. I can't name 90% of the Transformers. And they start weaving in this weird, like, creationist lore mythology about, you know, the Transformers and whatnot. And I'm just like, what is going on? But like you said, the bright spot is in the end. If you're just looking to stare at absolutely insane panel work, just overwhelming panel work, and in a good way, this book is number one for that.
We've described it as many times as something that's like a child with their toys playing around and just ramming them together, and their parents bought them every single toy, so they're just throwing them down for like the biggest fight that you've ever seen. But at the same time, there's some weird semblance of story, and quite honestly, like, the story in this series is absolutely bonkers, right? You guys would say that, like, from issue to issue, it's like there's like a small trailing story that kind of interconnects things. And I mean, I mean it definitely connects things, but probably 40% of this series is just small asides or one page actions or like weird little panels of people like saying puns or mentioning something that I've never heard of, like just them throwing callbacks to a million billion things that you've never heard of. But at the same time, it doesn't matter because you realize that it's all just fluff, right? Or at least that's just how I took it. Did you guys take it in the same way?
If you're not familiar with Scioli's art, I mean, it has a very heavy Jack Kirby influence. I mean, specifically Jack Kirby from the early 70s when he's doing the New Gods and Commandy and OMAC, which that is my bread and butter. Those are some of my favorite comics of all time. So I immediately gravitate towards Scioli's art. But what's really interesting, instead of just calling or mimicking Kirby visually, he really captures the rhythm that Kirby's comics had in the early 70s. And Kirby would kind of structure the issues in these little three-page vignettes. And that's how this series is sort of structured, you know? So
So you're saying that this is like a huge callback to like old 70s comics.
It with a very sort of unique spin on it. I mean, Kirby worked with a very tight grid for most of the time. He would do the big splash page to open the issue, and then it would be a big double page spread after that. But most of the story and narrative was done with a typical 6-panel grid. Scioli is kind of just taking that idea and just pushing it as far as he can, even to the point where he's doing these amazing double page spreads where you have like 3 different stories going on the 2-page spread. You know what I mean? You have different dialogues going on. Issue 3 for me is kind of the one where it all kind of comes together. The tone of the story, Scioli's art. There's that amazing double page spread in issue 3 where it's the funeral for General
Flag.
No, is it General Flag or General Hawk? I can't remember which one.
I think it's Flag.
Okay. Suffice to say, there are so many names and characters in this book. You know, it's okay. It's okay if you forgot one. It's all right. There are so many to forget. I mean, not that they are forgetful characters, but every single issue introduces another dozen or 2 dozen. Or I swear, in one issue of the first volume, I think it was issue 3 or maybe 4, they just every single page had like a dozen.
You're right,
like,
Paul. It's
like
hard.
8 new characters, 8 or 9 new characters.
And that's that itself is also a very Kirby thing. I mean, in those OMAC issues and Commandy issues, Kirby's just introducing new characters like every page. And and a lot of times they end up getting tossed away and forgotten because that's just the way he worked. But
this is where people like Grant Morrison dig into the old archives of comics and they say, well, here's this guy that showed up on one page. Let's make a whole comic series about him anyways.
But yes, so that's why I was gravitated towards Scioli's art because of that. It's being able to take that sort of the essence of Kirby and just really push as far as he can. So that double page spread in issue 3 where you have these 2 Transformers that are tipping over an aircraft carrier. At the same time, you have other panels telling different parts of the same story along the top and bottom of the page. It's just so overwhelming. And it really slows down your eye. And you kind of you can't take it all in at once. You really have to take it piece by piece. Which is really interesting for an action comic to really sort of slow your eye down and make you look at each page and each moment separately.
Yeah.
It has a very unique feel in that sense.
And I think that coming from your standard comic book and reading a book like this where you do have to slow down, like I had to reread volume 1 twice just because I realized that I didn't grasp it completely, simply because I was flying through it because I'm used to just focusing on word bubbles and the art kind of falls in place or it becomes is obvious to me. But with this series, there's so much happening that if you skip like a small fraction of one of those 2-page spreads, you're going to miss a chunk of the story straight up. Did you find that to be similar when you were reading it? I know that, you know, we've all tried to reread these a couple times before we got into it today. But did you find that to be like a similar thing?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you would sort of miss a little interaction in the corner of one of the big spreads. And then if you missed that, guess what? Like the next little narrative might follow those 2 or 3 characters. And you're like, well, when the hell did this start? And you have to go back and sort of dig up exactly, you know, the other threads of the narrative. I mean, what Paul said about the 3-page vignette really makes sense because I've always found with this book that frequently things will make sense within the confines of the page that they're on, but then you'll just flip the page and it's like, whoa, what happened? Not exactly a smooth transition, and it's certainly not one of those books where you get like the bubbles at the top of the page that says the next day or 2 hours before or things like
very
that.
Very rarely, yeah.
Right. Yeah. You definitely get the sense because, I mean, the meat of the story is Cybertron, the planet where the Transformers are from, is basically invading Earth, right? So this, the stakes are so
huge. Wait, that's what's happening? No.
Apparently.
Shit.
The stakes are so big, like there you don't really have a moment to catch your breath. And I think the way it might be confusing, but I think Scioli's kind of pushing that because it would be confusing. I mean, it's confusing to the characters. They have no idea what's going on. And the sort of example I use is, if you're playing a video game and there's cut sequences between when you're playing, it's like Scioli takes that the story that's that long and just cuts out the parts where they're fighting and just has the cut sequences. So it can be confusing, but I think that's on purpose to distill the narrative down to just the biggest moments.
Oh, sure. And it, if you want to, you know, relate this back to that whole just a kid playing in the yard with his toys, you know, the kid's not going to sit down with his two action figures and have them break into some sort of extrapolation or whatnot about what exactly is going on. The action figures aren't going to have a discussion about sort of breaking down the plot for everybody. They're just going to keep blowing up shit. So yeah, there's no time for explaining things in this book. And sometimes things comes together and sometimes they don't. And you flip the page and all of a sudden there's a Viking ship with like Decepticon icons on the flags. And then there's me spending 5 minutes trying to figure out how we arrived at that page.
Yeah.
And then in the DVD commentary notes, they explain that even they weren't really certain why that page was there. And then I stopped reading for the night because why continue at that point?
I don't know. The Viking ship, that gives me more incentive to keep going. I guess that's
that
really
was
different.
Insane.
It feels like in this series, they are constantly just trying to outdo themselves in the outrageous look and feel and just what could Cobra potentially do to look even more evil, you know, and or what could the G.I. Joes do to be more badass? You know, it's constantly like that, up and up and up and up and up. They do the same thing with Megatron and they do the same thing with all of the Autobots. It's constantly trying to outdo themselves and yet still tell a semi-understandable narrative at the same time. And I think up until probably issues 6 and 7, I think they were doing that nonstop. And 6 and 7, they realized, oh, we need to actually tell this story. And then they got into some real deep, dark shit. On top of, you know, the end of the first volume where, like, everyone died or something, you know. especially in issue, I think it was issue 6 or issue 7, there was one panel where they hadn't done any explaining. And all the dialogue boxes are usually, like, 3 or 4 lines, maybe, like, you know, lines total, which means like a sentence or two. And then there's just this one giant word bubble explaining everything that's happened for the last 7 issues.
Yep.
I was reading that on the train and I just started laughing. Because it's like, oh, thanks for cluing me in after 7 issues of me trying really hard to see what's actually happening.
Info dump.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because that was maybe one criticism I kind of have of the series. I mean, despite me thinking that it's absolutely brilliant in every other way, because it ramps up so quickly, by the time you get to issue 4, it's like there's nowhere further for it to go. I mean, by the end of issue 1, you have the G.I. Joes invading Cybertron.
Yeah.
There's no buildup. It's like, well, we have to go fight this giant mechanical planet that's invading Earth. And I think issue 3 kind of get this full culmination of the tone and the pacing and Sioli's art. Also, issue 3 has a Bee Gees reference, which if you're going to make a Venn diagram of shit I like, Jack Kirby and the Bee Gees, I'm right in between those circles. I'm like the only one that tiny spot where those circles touch. But when you get to issue 4, it's like the pace is so fast, you don't get time to catch your breath. So issues 4, 5, and 6 kind of feel like samey. You know, they have the same pace and the same tone, and there's interesting moments in each issue because that's the way Sioli writes it. It's like these just moments that keep happening. But the tone of the book really shifts with issue 7, and I think that was necessary for them to kind of step back and say, look, we're going to do something else now.
Yeah.
We can't keep going at this pace.
And with issue 7, it felt like they kind of grounded the comic. But if only to say, hey, we're actually going to try to root this in semblance of a story, not just try to play at we're making a cool comic book with all of our dreams in it. And it was a shock initially, but then it kind of wrapped everything up in my head this is actually kind of well thought out if they're going to play it this route. And I don't want to spoil it because 7 just came out pretty recently as of the day that we're recording this. So I don't want to give it all away because it was a cool twist and I really enjoyed it.
Isn't the twist more in like 6 though?
Like the last page of issue 6 amazing twist. But I mean issue 7, I mean without spoiling it as much as I want to, issue 7 I think was the most fascinating because there was a shift in not just the story but Sioli's art, which I know I've been saying this a lot, but I really think this is the perfect comic book because it's that melding of the art and the narrative. You can't take one without the other. They're so intertwined. So Sioli is still doing the Kirby, Jim Steranko sort of 60s layouts and page design, but then issue 7, he's introducing the sort of Dark Knight Returns, little tiny panels, and there's these weird flashbacks that are kind of like Watchmen-esque in the sort of symmetry of the page. So it's like suddenly he's calling on these 80s comics that, as much as I hate the term, we're deconstructions of what comics are. So it's like him taking a step back and saying, all right, the series is shifting, my style is shifting, I'm going to call on these visual clues from these comics that were pushing or changing what comics looked like in the 80s to show that.
Right.
Maybe I'm just reading too much into it, but that's what I got from issue 7 and why it was so exciting to me.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting take. And I mean, if we're going to get right into the art, I honestly think we should at some point, you know.
Yeah.
But if we're going to actually talk about the art, I mean, just think about this in like the grand scheme. Honestly, if you, the listener, have not seen this book, I implore you to go on, you know, go to your comic shop, pick up an issue, or go grab the free Comic Book Day special, which I'm pretty sure is free on Comixology. Just go read that just to get a sample. Just to get a sample of like the outrageous, ridiculous look and style of this book. And I say outrageous and ridiculous because it is so out there. It feels like the biggest action-packed story you've ever seen. And it's so true to form of what I think G.I. Joe's and Transformers represents, that there, in my mind, can be no other artist at this point. Like, until I find someone that's going to do more batshit, insane, cool stuff like this, I don't want to read a Transformer or G.I. Joe's book that isn't like this.
I can see where some people might find Sealy's art off-putting because it's so different, but the way he lays out the pages and the way he just uses the scope and size of the page and even the way he uses color, it's such just a classic feeling comic,
yeah,
despite being just so different from everything else out there.
The one thing that I will say was a kind of a bummer for me was when I realized that Sealy does a lot of hand-drawn everything. Like, I should say, everything's hand-drawn, obviously, because it's art, but he does a lot of hand-drawn wording. Like, he'll do locations in big boxy letters that he drew rather than like use the typeface for.
Yeah.
And then as I was reading through issue 6 today or something, there was a name tag for one of the Joes, and the lettering went over the art, and like, because the name tag was behind another character, and since it wasn't written in, the lettering was on top of the art for the character instead of being just on the tag. And I was kind of bummed because in my head, for some reason, I just assumed that everything was handwritten. And I realized that hand lettering is super tough and takes a long time and really fucks up your process if you do it wrong. In my head, I saw a little bit of how the sausage was made, and I was like, ugh, no, we don't want sausage. Because they made sausage in issue 7.
Right,
no.
Well, Mike, you actually bring up a good point, and I noticed this with more predominantly with the last two or three issues as well. But did you guys notice how there's quite a few text bubbles, and sometimes they're pretty big text bubbles, and like the art just eclipses like half of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I noticed that a lot.
And I don't mean like the top or bottom part of the bubble. I mean like literally like vertically, half of the bubble is missing.
And you can't even read what the character was saying? Oh my gosh.
Oh my god. What was that? Is that a Kirby thing too? Because...
Are you talking about because I know there's a couple panels where people be talking at the same time and the word bubbles overlap?
No.
Well, there's that, but then there will be a word bubble and...
Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember specifically in 5, I think it was, there was a character like, you must wait, blah, blah, blah. He was giving this whole big rant and like half of a Transformer is just taking up that bubble because it's like that person was talking down at someone else. But I think the idea was that the action was overlaying what that person was saying. So it's another piece of storytelling where instead of having the little dash dash to cut a character off, they just physically put the art over the box to say, fuck you, you can't even hear this or read this. Like, it's so
to say,
cool.
You're not really here for this anyway.
In my mind, I thought, you know, they've got to be putting the character over that bubble because it's not relevant to the story right now, right? Maybe it was relevant because they also used that to hide what a character was saying so you didn't know what someone was doing. And a lot of the times they'll hide what the Transformers are saying with little waveforms, which, by the way, that's so cool. I didn't know that was a thing in Transformers. But also, they would do that to hide what someone like Cobra was saying or some like Megatron was saying to another person, and they would just overlay that to say as if, oh, this person, you know, blocked what you as the reader could actually see or hear if you were there in person.
Yeah.
In a way that actually worked. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just going to say I think that's one of the things I like so much about this book, because someone who's a fan of the craft of making comics and how comics function, that's just something you can only do in comics. Like, how do we show this character as being drowned out by sound? We'll just make it visual. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's taking full advantage of the medium, which is, I think, I honestly believe is pretty rare nowadays. Like, you don't see a lot of bigger popular comics taking advantage, doing things like that, simply because it's just, maybe it just doesn't occur to them, or the artist in this case isn't as heavily involved as Scioli is in this book. And what a beautiful way to remind you that there are things happening on the page outside of the dialogue, right? I don't know. How else did you say it? Nick, sorry, I never realized I cut you off.
Oh, no, that's okay. No, I think you brought up a great point in that they're definitely willing to demonstrate these different techniques. And I think what's great about a book like this is that if you've made it through issue one and you're happy with what that is, you're going to be okay with everything else they do from then on. It's not like someone's going to get to issue three and be like, whoa, 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 pump the brakes. Like, I didn't know I was, you know, signing up for this or whatever. Right? And I think that's what I like about this series is really, it's like, all right, you liked issue one, continue on, because I'm just going to keep going insane. And if you didn't, that's fine. You know, there's the door. And so I think in that way, the series doesn't have to worry about maintaining some balance of artistic integrity versus sort of what popular demand requires.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing I really like about the waveform idea that you guys were bringing up is that it also allows for sort of a coded language or a plot that sort of can be layered underneath that where you don't understand. Because in modern comics, when you're dealing with foreign languages or things like that, that might conceal things to the reader. Obviously, A, you have to deal with the readers that actually understand the language and
right.
which gives them a false sense of superiority. So they're going to keep reading anyway, for the same reason that people who understand Spanish really liked Resident Evil 4, but we'll get into that later. But with this, there's no way of understanding. It's not even like Morse code or something like that, or like Trillium, which came up with its own alphabet. So it just works perfectly, because the only other alternative is to just continue using a foreign language in a comic, and most readers, I think, are not happy with that. So then they just put those little cornered brackets around it and say, you know, it's in a foreign language.
Translated from Spanish.
Yeah, it's in a foreign language, even though you're reading English. Yeah. So it's so creative what they've done here. And like I said, I just love that you're either along for the ride or you're not. He doesn't have to worry about pleasing one person or another. It's just either you're willing to put up with all of this or you aren't.
Yeah, it feels like almost like a work of like outsider art in that sense, because you feel that Scioli and Barbara are just doing stuff to entertain them. And luckily, I'm on the same wavelength as them, it seems, so I'm entertained as well. You know, like, yeah, exactly. I mean, like I said, like I mentioned, any book that's going to have a Bee Gees reference, and a pretty explicit one, that's like right in my wheelhouse. But the way that the artwork is laid out, and the way that Scioli will sometimes just have like a panel or a page and like label it with a title, you know, it's just something that you don't see in other comics, and it makes it, and the way that he does the colors with the crayons, it has a really a handmade, like punk rock feel to it.
Absolutely.
For a book that's about these sort of multi-million dollar franchises.
Yeah.
So the fact that Hasbro, who owned the rights for both franchises, and IDW is like just letting them go nuts, it's so refreshing.
Well, it helps. Obviously, it helps that like this series is selling pretty well, from what I understand, or at least according to the previews and all this stuff. They're, you know, the smash hit of the summer or something like that that they've touted it as. Yeah. I think that goes to show that people want this kind of stuff, or people are willing to experiment with a balls to the wall, action packed, ridiculous series of minisodes or episodes of G.I. Joe and Transformers somehow combined into one universe, where that not only throw back to this nostalgia feeling if you have that for these characters and for this series, these series, but also that like maybe people like us, like Nick and I, who, you know, had no interest in this series until really we were told about it, or at least that's how I was, just are saying, okay, I'm willing to make, you know, try this out, and we get so invested in the ridiculous like world of it that we can't help but keep reading. And I mean, like, that's how I'm taking it. I'm like, what more could they do? What crazy thing could potentially come next? I need to see this. This is one of those books that hooks you so hard that if you leave, it's going to hurt more than when you originally got in, you know, as terrible as a, you know, analogy that is.
It's getting kind of dark, Mike.
Yeah. You know, as comics readers, I feel like there's this weird, very difficult line to walk between fun and silly, and I feel like it's tough to do that. You want to have big action comics that are kind of irreverent and kind of fun, but all too often it becomes like self-parody or it's just too silly, and I feel this book so far sort of walks that line perfectly. I mean, there's some pretty absurd moments, but it doesn't feel out of place given the huge scope of the story.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a part, I think issue 5 it is, there's a part where like Cobra attacks and they drop a bomb and the sound effect is Cobroom, which is so dumb, but it's perfect. Like, it just fits so well. So I love a book that's able to be fun without being dumbed down, able to be a little bit silly without feeling like it's pandering. You know what I mean? It's just, it's a the tone, I think, is just so unique among comics today. That's one of the reasons I keep coming back to it.
Well, and I think part of that goes along with the idea that, like, is so old school in a way that when you think about it, it's something like the G.I. Joes always win. The Transformers, like the Autobots, they always win. Like, they're the good guys. The good guys are going to beat the bad guys. So when you embrace that mentality, when you think the G.I. Joes are always good guys, and Cobra is always the bad guy, then you take those two ideas and you push them to the most extreme differences where there's no gray area. There is, you're a good guy, you're a bad guy. And so when you go that far and you say there is no middle ground, you can be as insane and irreverent as possible when you're, you know, the G.I. Joes are carrying the American flag and they're like, we're doing this for the greater America. And they can be so outlandish that, like, nowadays when someone says something like that, you laugh. But in this book, it doesn't feel out of place because in your head, you're like, well, the G.I. Joes are super patriotic and they are fighting for the better will of America. You know, and like when they talk about this global scope and stuff, they don't mean the globe. They mean America. And you know what? That's okay. Because I'm not looking for like a political statement coming from G.I. Joes versus Transformer or Transformers versus G.I. Joe. I'm looking for a G.I. Joes are going to win. Transformers are going to win. Megatron is going to lose. Cobra Commander is going to lose because that's what I want. And yes, this is going to ebb and flow and it's going to be, oh no, Cobra Commander did this thing and General Wolf died or whoever. It's like, oh no, it's like soap opera stuff where you know that at the end of the story, they're going to win because that's just how it happens. The good guys always win. It's so childish, but it's nice. It's almost heartwarming because nowadays, you know, in comics, we're looking at this, you know, everything, especially with like the big two, even, you know, comics coming from indie publishers where everyone's in a gray area and no one's just good because they're trying to be as real to life as possible. This series says, no, there's no realism here. Like the G.I. Joes can go from, you know, underwater all the way out to space without really making any sort of transition. They don't need to put on a special suit because you can just assume that their cars that they're driving can also fly and can also go into space. It's okay. I really enjoy that about the series. It's just they're unapologetic about the ridiculousness and they know that you're in for this like super fun, exciting ride where things are going to be sad, but then don't worry, we're going to get better. Everything's going to be, you know, uplifting at the end. It's like it's your standard action movie and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, that's not afraid to sort of be a little silly. Like what's the panel where Destro meets is it Megatron?
Yeah.
Like that panel, just the sort of,
oh my gosh. I'm just imagining it because it's just the Silver Man, Metal Man talking to a giant robot and they decide to combine forces.
And then don't they like debate over what they're going to call themselves at that point? Or
Yeah,
what's the big long name they ended up deciding with? Like, or it's the Decepticron Cobracropolis or something?
Their location, yeah. the Decepticobracropolis?
Yeah. Seeing that on page makes me giggle every single time.
I saw that, yeah. I was like, they've got a real German way of naming things, you know, you just slam all the nouns together and you just make a new one.
And I just love that you just have this big image of Destro's face and it says, Gun God, meet your avatar.
I want that on a poster. I want that on a wall-sized poster on my wall that I can look up at every morning and pray to. Oh my gosh.
See, I think the image for me by like last night, I was like, that's it. I've seen and done everything there is to do with comics. I'm done. Was the one where Snake Eyes ninja kicks the oversized shot glass into the Decepticon's face. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's it. Comics are done. Nothing is ever gonna come close to this again. This is just, and then it turns into that just full-on brawl in the cantina, and then you've got the what do you call them technically? What's the generic term for Transformers?
Cybertronians?
Cybertronians. Yeah.
Anyway, there's one over in the corner on like the player piano, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's
exactly
it. We're done.
And then two pages later, one of my favorite panels is the United Nations field trip. So you have the United Nations
with the bus transformer.
Like the bus is a Decepticon, and there's a bunch of Cobra like soldiers coming out of it, and they invade the United Nations.
And this is what makes this comic so great is that like you can sit back and you can laugh at the fun of it. Like it's not that it's a parody of anything, like you were saying, Paul. It's that it is completely owning its outrageousness. to the point where you kind of you respect it for being able to hold on to that and say, no, mm-hmm. just keep going, man. We're not going to reference it again. But we threw that little Autobot in the corner just because. Yeah. Or especially in issue, I think it was issue 7, when they were calling out all the other G.I. Joe regimes that were, like, there's, like, a Canadian version, there's, like, G.I. Joe 2000, like they're, like...
War Force 2000 or something.
Yeah, and one guy says, oh, I can't believe they pulled us out, or pulled the mothballs off of us for this. Like, what the hell?
Yeah. Funny thing, I actually, like, Wikipedia'd that little group that you were just talking about, and it's, like, yeah, they were, like... I guess they were about, like, experimental warfare weapons or something, and whenever some new writer was put on, he was encouraged to just, like, kill off all the unnecessary ones, so he, like, blew them all up in one explosion except for one. I was like, oh my god. Oh, I love the people that are, like, super, like, really, really specific experts of things. They're like, this guy knows how to work the refrigerator. So yeah.
This guy knows how to tame blind lions. Like, so, you know, as much as we can gush about this book, if you had to say there was something bad about this book, you know, what are the negative aspects of this book? What is something that you can definitely critique on it and say, you know, maybe they aren't doing this right? Do you guys have anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, for starters, on a very simple note, the narrative does not hold your hand, and it's so complicated that you struggle with whether or not there's a lot of narrative there and you're missing it, or there's virtually none and you're completely way over reading. And so trying to figure out how serious or how in-depth or how layered it is, if you're the sort of person that stuff will keep you up at night, it's definitely going to bug you for a bit, without a doubt.
Yeah, and I kind of agree. And kind of like I said a little bit earlier, it's you reach a point, I think, with issue 4 and 5 where I kind of got confused because there was not a lot of, there was no exposition. And you reach this point where the narrative is moving at such a, it feels like it's moving quickly, but not a lot is happening. You just have a lot of big action set pieces, which are lovely to look at, but the narrative kind of gets lost in those issues. I think that's corrected by the time you get to the end of issue 6 and issue 7. And I think issue 7 kind of demonstrates where they can take this story. It gets a little darker there for a minute, but at the end it's back to the
thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There were some pretty dark scenes in the second.
Can I just say, just generally speaking, like, maybe she did. Like, I thought she left her kids in the house. Did she leave her kids in the house?
She left her kids in the house.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So, reader or listener, you should definitely go read the series regardless, but yeah.
Because if those sorts of vague conversations aren't the sorts of things that get you going, what's going on, you know?
Yeah, I'm really biting my tongue about issue 7 because I can really get into it, but it's worth checking out. It's worth sticking with the series to get to that point because I think there is some really interesting stuff going on there. But yeah, that'd be my one critique is I feel like there reaches a point where the narrative kind of gets lost in the action sequences where I would just kind of, I didn't know who these characters were. Each issue has notes from Barbara and Scioli explaining what's happening in each page, but I really shouldn't have to rely on that. You know what I mean? I reached a point where it's like, I'm kind of waiting to get to that so I could figure out what's going on in the issue.
That's something I have to credit them. At the end of every issue, they've got just a plethora of notes, and it is so cool, like page by page, almost panel by panel. Admittedly, I didn't read every single one of them, but I skimmed enough to say, like, holy cow, one, these guys really love this series, and two, I wish that I had this for every book. And I know some writers do this, like Kieran Gillen, for an example. He would write breakdowns for his issues of Uber and for Wicked and Divine that he would post online. That being said, like, it was helpful at times. But on the whole, like, I don't think a book necessarily needs that. It's nice to have, but it's not something that you should say, well, if I don't get this now, I'll just read the notes at the end. Like, this isn't a Lord of the Rings novel, you know?
I always challenged myself to at least get all the way through the issue and then go to the notes, no matter how amazingly tempting it was to just go there right away when things got super confusing.
Yeah, I would say, I think my critique of this series would have to be along the lines similar to what you said, Paul, where the narrative does sometimes get lost in the action. And especially since I was reading it all in digital, I had a little bit of trouble following it in some places where I had to reread a page a couple times, or I had to reread the same panels over and over to make sure that I knew that I was following them in the correct order, because I wasn't sure if like they were being set up properly, or I would just switch to one page view and I could just read the whole comic myself. So there was sometimes like I didn't really realize that Optimus was coming back at any point. I don't know. I felt like I lost, like there was a beat that I missed that said that Optimus was back or coming back, and then suddenly in issue 5 he was just like there front and center, and I was like, okay, I guess Optimus is back, cool, sure, let's just continue to do this thing. And I followed along, because that's kind of how I read it initially, was I just kind of pushed through the series, and then when I went back and read it a second time, I started to catch a few more things that I missed, which is, you know, like a good thing and a bad thing in some ways. You know, we talk about comics that are good because when you go back and read them a second time, you get the story better, you get it, and we praise comics for that sometimes, to say this is rereadable. And in this case, I felt like the series is rereadable. It's definitely so out there that you could laugh again. But it's, in some ways, it's almost a detriment, only because it feels like you have to read it a second time to ensure that you got the comic completely. Do you guys feel that same way?
Yeah, that's not a big issue for me. That doesn't bother me too much as a reader, but I can see why you would say that. It's a book that I felt like I wanted to reread just to kind of experience it again.
Yeah.
But that kind of, being such a big Morrison fan and apologist, like that kind of confusing stuff never really bothers me, obviously. So.
They're one and the same.
Yeah. Do you guys have any final thoughts on Transformers versus G.I. Joe before we sign off?
I've said it before and I'll say it again. If it's not the best book on the stands right now, it's the book I'm most excited to read every week it comes out. It's like nothing else on the stands, and it feels like it's a book that is written just for me. And I'm glad that it wasn't, because I'm glad you guys enjoyed it too. So
yeah, it's definitely the sort of book I would say, you know, we have the wonderful advantage of being able to tell everyone issue number one, or technically issue number zero, it's free. Go ahead, get your hands on it. If it's your cup of tea, you'll probably know within a page or two. And if the art completely scares you off and you find it overwhelming and you say that, oh, it looks old and it looks gross or whatever, I would suggest other things beyond just not reading the book, some of which are not as polite. But that is the thing. You'll know real quick whether or not it's your sort of thing. And despite not completely growing up in the era of both of these, you know, being born in, you know, the late 80s, I can definitely see how people who did grow up with this really appreciate this, because it's much more, it's not sort of a nod and a wink that says, weren't all these things goofy and weren't all these things dumb? And can you believe that there was an action figure for this and there was a character that did that? I think it respects the sort of emotion that it evokes in the people who respected it back then. I think it really brings back that feeling of imagination and nostalgia, and not just tapping into that nostalgia bank of, you know, this equals money time and time again, but really recapturing that feeling I think that people had originally, and not just a parody or an homage. It goes beyond that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I would definitely say, you know, just to your point, Nick, that you should get the number zero. This is one of the very rare books out there that we can recommend that says, if you don't like this at the first issue or in the first couple pages, you're not going to like the rest of this book. Unlike, you know, a lot of other books will say, no, give it an issue or give it an arc. Read the first trade. You'll get it. This book is not like that.
If it's Jonathan Hickman, like 18 issues, guys. Yeah. 18 issues. It gets better.
Yeah, this is one of those books that I would be surprised if you go into this book with a level-headed mind saying, you know, I'm willing to try something fun and out there and adventurous. This is a book that is going to sit really well with you. So I would highly suggest going out, checking out that zero issue on Comixology for free. And if you like it, buy the trade, buy the subsequent single issues. It's a book that is unlike no other. As we've said, as Paul and Nick have both said, it is a book that is unlike no other, and hopefully you will enjoy it. I think you really will. Thanks for listening to I Read Comic Books, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This week's episode was produced and edited by Mike Rappin. That's me. This week's music was brought to you by The New Law and Infinity Shred. You can keep up with this podcast through iTunes and Stitcher. We'd love it if you rated us 5 stars.
If you want to contact us or give us something to talk about, send us an email at cyborg@destroythecybe.org.